from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
We're now unified behind a plan to responsibly wind down the war in Afghanistan, a plan that trains Afghan security forces, transitions to the Afghans, and builds a partnership that can endure after our combat mission in Afghanistan ends.
And that's President Obama summing up what the results appear to be from the NATO summit in Chicago. We'll talk about the meeting that went on in Chicago, formally approving a plan to draw down international forces. And under the plan, the Afghan military will take the lead role by next summer, though the U.S. will maintain a presence past the year 2014. We'll talk about the challenges ahead in Afghanistan and the evolving role of NATO in world affairs. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The 10-year war in Afghanistan is the longest war in U.S. history, but it appears that finally it is entering a new phase. Vowing at the two-day NATO summit in Chicago to end the war responsibly and to inaugurate a transitional decade of peace, President Obama also spoke about taking a major step toward that war's end. He and other world leaders prepared a plan that will presumably shift international forces from a combat role next year to a supporting role, with the expectation that all combat troops will be out of the country by the year 2014. In this opening forum hour, we discuss what lies ahead for the U.S. and Afghanistan, as well as what lies ahead for the troubled nation of Afghanistan and for the ongoing NATO alliance and its strategic partnership. Join us in studio is William Cole. He's Senior Director for Governance, Law, and Strategy with the Asia Foundation. They're a nonprofit, non-governmental organization committed to the development of a peaceful, prosperous, just, and open Asia-Pacific region. Welcome, William Cole.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you here. We also have Charles Kupchan with us from the nation's capital. He's Senior Fellow in the Council on Foreign Relations, Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown, and former Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council. His new book is called No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. And welcome, Charles Kupchan.
Happy to join you.
Glad to have you. Also, I want to welcome Sarwar Kashmiri, who is Senior Fellow with the Atlanta Council's International Security Program and a Fellow with the Foreign Policy Association. And he's with us this morning from up in Vermont. Welcome.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
And also, let me mention your new book, which is called NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete. Let me begin with William Cole here in studio and just say that NATO troops are going to presumably be training, advising, and assisting Afghans. And Secretary General Rasmussen said this withdrawal will take place over the next 2.5 years. I guess the first real question is, how viable is this, particularly with all the strife and with all the corruption in Afghanistan and with only, I believe, 42% of operations presently being led by Afghans?
Well, in terms of viability of the transition, Michael, I think there are obviously serious questions. The commitment of the United States to a strategic alliance with Afghanistan is now clear. We won't be leaving entirely. There'll be something like 15,000 or 20,000 troops at the end of the day in 2014. The real question is whether the ANA, the Afghan National Army, can really carry the ball once NATO troops are down and they've taken over and the Afghans have taken over the full role for combat, and nobody really knows the answer to that question. What I hear from troops on the ground is they've been impressive with the progress that's been made, but there's still a long way to go. The insurgency has gotten tougher. There seems to be a willingness to negotiate on the part of the Quetta Shura, possibly. The Haqqani network, working out of Fatah in Pakistan, seems less willing to negotiate. So there are a lot of variables here.
Let's talk about those distinctions, because a lot of people just think Taliban. They don't realize now that there's division within the Taliban as well. And the clans and so forth. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is when we say the Taliban. Taliban, of course, includes a lot of people, and that goes all the way from a very small and dedicated group who will never agree with with backing off from a fight with NATO or allow this government to stay in place. That's a very small group. Then you have a larger group, which is really there's a set of issues, most of that have to do with justice. Either they feel that there are horrendous things that have been done to them and they're fighting and they're looking for some kind of redress of those grievances, or they've committed tremendous outrages. And so they really can't go home. So there's a second group that's there. Probably the largest group, probably 40, 50, 60% of the Taliban are paid troops. You've also got a lot of people who – Pashtuns who are very unhappy with what they see as a foreign occupation. And some of them would think of themselves as Taliban or being on the Taliban side. It's a very nebulous term. But let me go to the other point. I think,
of course, could you say a very nebulous term? Our forces broke the Taliban momentum. Those words are directly from President Obama. Is he dreaming here? I mean, particularly since there are insurgents all over from safe havens in Pakistan.
Yeah. No. Exactly. That's now when you talk about when you talk about it in that way, what you're talking about is primarily the Quetta Shura that Mullah Omar runs. Now that the Quetta Shura, based in Quetta, Baluchistan, Pakistan. The Quetta Shura has been degraded somewhat. The Pakistanis have picked up some of their members. There's been the attacks on the mid-level commanders under the Quetta Shura has definitely degraded the Taliban under Omar. There are some questions about whether the extent to which a deal cut at the top would actually be able to hold with the lower level commanders on the ground, because those mid levels have been so seriously degraded. That's the Quetta Shura. The other side of the Taliban is the Haqqani network, based out of Fatah, the federally administrated tribal areas up against the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. And the Haqqani network is the side of the Taliban that's been doing most of the damage over the last year or two, and there's been some degrading of the Haqqani network, but they are well placed all the way. They're close to Kabul. A lot of the action that's been going on in Kabul has been coming out of Fatah, out of the Haqqani network. They're very mixed up with the drug trade, organized crime. There are Islamic extremists, but this is a mixed soup that's going on. It would be very hard to displace them at this point, to displace them out of their out of the growing entrenchment that they have around Kabul and in eastern Afghanistan.
And again, William Cole is Senior Director for Governance, Law and Strategy with the Asia Foundation. Charles Kupchan is Senior Fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations. Let's explore this a little more in terms of the potential efficacy of Afghan security forces, Charles Kupchan. I mean, certainly around Kabul, there seems to be some strength. But when you go into the south of the country or the east of the country, the military seems a lot less effective. And the police and the Karzai administration continue to be rampant, at least from what I read, with corruption and with all kinds of disabilities.
Well, I think that behind the decision to start moving toward training and start heading toward the exits is a very clear moving of the goalposts, in the sense that the Obama administration and its NATO allies began with a belief that they could really change the game in Afghanistan, that they could lead the effort to beat back the insurgents, the Taliban, to stand up a functioning state that would rest on a reasonably functioning government and police forces and an army, and that they would leave Afghanistan intact. And I think that's simply not worked out. The Obama administration has realized that, and it is therefore being driven by the need to wind the war down regardless of the situation on the ground. And so I think what's happening now is NATO is headed toward the Afghanistan it can get rather than the Afghanistan that it wants. And it will continue to focus, I think, very clearly on counterterrorism, use force as necessary to go after al-Qaeda cells or other extremist cells to try to reconstitute themselves in the country. But the idea that NATO will leave behind a country that is generally run from Kabul, that it will leave behind an army that enjoys a certain amount of control over the country, I think that's just gone by the wayside. And the key question over the coming months will be how much progress can be made in training the army and what kind of political compact can be struck with the Taliban. Because I don't think anybody believes anymore that the Taliban can be defeated. The question is, can they be co-opted? Can there be some kind of functioning political system in the country that gets buy-in from the various ethnic actors, the various political actors? And I think Obama and his counterparts in Europe are going to be pushing hard on that kind of political structure because the military side of things has not gone as well as expected.
Well, one of the concerns about any kind of negotiation with the Taliban is there have been real gains on behalf of women in Afghanistan, and a concern would be in maintaining those gains. I mean, right now, after the foreign troops leave, and I'm wondering, by the way, where the women were in the Chicago talks. I don't believe they were there, but there hasn't, not even in a consulting capacity, but there are 3 million girls now being educated in schools in Afghanistan. A third of the parliament seats are held by women in Afghanistan. Negotiating with the Taliban seems to put a cloud over all that, doesn't it?
Well, I think the U.S., will do as best as it can to save what it's achieved. And you're right to point out that significant gains have been made, that the civilian side of things has moved forward, that more women are in school, that human rights have improved. There is more education, more economic activity than there was before. But I think one has to be realistic and to acknowledge that some of those gains are now going to be compromised. And I think that the United States and its NATO allies have sort of come to the realization that countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Somalia aren't as easy to fix as one might hope. Is there a certain loss of moral authority that comes with that recognition? Yes, there is. But at a time when the United States and its European allies are hard-pressed because of economic crisis at home, I think there is a scaling back of the ambition, a replacement of idealism with realism, and an acknowledgement, even if unstated, that some of those gains on the human rights front may not survive the new strategy that calls for winding down the presence of foreign troops.
And what about the role of Pakistan, and particularly vis-a-vis supply routes? President Zardari was apparently expecting or asking for, maybe even supplicating, some kind of apology from President Obama, which he did not receive, about the 24 soldiers who were killed in the U.S. airstrike back in November, and also the feeling in Pakistan that their sovereignty was violated. I mean, Pakistan is a key player in anything that's going to continue in Afghanistan. And also, of course, we haven't even brought up Iran on the other side of the border, but Pakistan has to be dealt with here in some fashion, doesn't it?
Yeah, no question about it. And I think the most significant setback in Chicago was the fact that a deal was not struck on reopening the convoy routes between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Another setback was the new president of France, Hollande, stuck by his commitment to get his troops, the French troops, out of Afghanistan this year rather than waiting until 2014. But I think, if there is a dark cloud over the broader strategy that NATO laid out over the last 2 days, it's what to do with Pakistan, because it's not just the convoy issue, it's the stability of the Pakistan government, it's the degree to which the intelligence services there are in cahoots with militant extremists, it's the degree to which the Pakistanis turned a blind eye to many of the most dangerous groups that are operating in the borderlands between the two countries. We don't yet have a strategy for dealing with these problems, and quite honestly, I think it is the absence of that strategy and frustration over what to do with Pakistan that has led Obama and his counterparts to say, listen, we gave it a college try, But we cannot sit around and spend the next 10, 20 years trying to fix Afghanistan if Pakistan is not going to help. We need to now practice damage limitation.
Although I was also struck by President Obama saying after the summit in Chicago, plans to withdraw are, and I'll use his word, irreversible. Charles Kupchan, again, a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international affairs at Georgetown. His book is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. And Sarwar Kashmiri's book is NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete. And let's talk with you about NATO, particularly Sarwar Kashmiri, in terms of, well, they came out of Chicago saying that NATO allies are going to pay their share of the $1.4 billion cost of the Afghan army and police, particularly with Europe's economy. How much can we depend on that?
Well, I think it was interesting. I thought there were two or three real setbacks from the NATO conference in Chicago, one of them being that the U.S. invited the president of Pakistan and then refused to meet with him, which I thought was a real insult and didn't have to be, almost churlish. I'm a great admirer of President Obama, but I thought in this case he was very badly advised.
Although we should mention Secretary Clinton did meet with the president
of
Pakistan.
Yes, but when you have a head of state to not go that length, I think was a big mistake. As far as the price concerned, it would take roughly $4.2 billion to run the Afghan security forces. Now, I might remind your listeners that this is greater than the entire federal budget of the Afghan government. It's also the amount of cash that leaves Kabul in satchels and suitcases every year. So the idea that the Afghan national forces will be able to support themselves is a little far-fetched. Now, in Chicago, there was a big move on to get the NATO allies to contribute to the roughly $1.8 billion that the U.S. Intends to put into this. But we've got commitments of a few hundred million dollars, but beyond that, it was not possible to do so. I am a real pessimist when that is concerned. I think the NATO allies were in Afghanistan to show solidarity with the United States as the leader of NATO. I think very few, with the possible exception of the United Kingdom, of the NATO allies really believed, as the neocons in the U.S. did, that the nation building could go on, that we could leave a stable, democratic, halfway decent Afghanistan. So it's taken 10 years for us in the United States to come to that realization. So I'm a pessimist when it comes to the Afghans being able to deploy their own forces. I'm a pessimist when it comes to the NATO allies sharing in the budget. I think ultimately, if that has to be done, the taxpayer, the American taxpayer, will have to foot the bill.
You've been advocating, in fact, read a rather cogent piece you did in The Guardian, shared leadership with the EU, more of a role for Europe, and even, I think, discussed the possibility of the EU having a permanent military headquarters for missions and keeping North America and U.S., Canada, that is, on this side and Europe on that side, but really making a stronger bond between the two.
Well, I've been looking at the defense expenditures of the European Union. There is a real misconception that the European Union doesn't spend enough on their defense. The fact of the matter is that the European Union defense budgets, when you add them together, are around $300 billion, which I might remind you was roughly the American defense budget prior to 9/11. The issue is that it's not spent wisely, so there are duplicative tank programs and duplicative fighter jet programs. And the reason that they're not able to eliminate duplication is the same reason that American senators aren't able to shut down bases in their states. It's a political issue. And my point is, why would the politicians in Europe want to make decisions which might lead to unemployment and elimination of industries in their countries if the United States has given Europe a defense credit card and said, hey, you know, if the heavy lifting really needs to get done, we'll come out, do it, pay for it, as the United States did in Libya. We paid almost $1 billion to get that war started. And so my point is that NATO is a piece of the transatlantic relationship, which is still very important. So why not take the important mechanisms of it and graft it to Europe's growing defense establishment, which has, by the way, over the last 10 years, sent some 88,000 soldiers and sailors and consultants and so on to different parts of the world, and connect NATO to the European establishment so that the Europeans can take care of problems in their own vicinity, their own defense, and that way we have a mechanism that connects North America to Europe if there is really a big bang. So that's what I've been advocating.
Well, I don't think, Charles Kupchan, you don't quite see it that way, do you?
I basically agree with Sawar's vision. I worry about the ability to see it come to fruition, and that's because I fear that NATO is now facing a European crisis rather than a transatlantic crisis, and that European crisis is on the surface taking the form of a financial crisis. The Eurozone is still teetering on the edge. We don't know whether Greece is going to default and leave that that single currency or not, but the differences about how to deal with the problem are eating away at the fabric of Europe. They are causing the renationalization of the European Union, perhaps the greatest geopolitical experiment of the 20th century is at stake. It's pulling apart. And even though I would agree with what Sarah was saying about the need for the European Union to step up to the plate, not so much by spending more on defense, but by pooling resources, I fear the opposite is happening, that Europe is not moving towards greater collective ambition. It's heading in the opposite direction. And that worries me about the long-term health of NATO, because if Americans continue to look across the Atlantic and believe that Europe is more of a liability than an asset, that Europe is not aggregating its capability, I'm afraid that it will gradually fall off America's geopolitical radar screen. And that's why I think even though the summit of the last couple of days made some progress, the big question in the future is Europe going to get its act together and remain an attractive suitor for the United States?
As we come up on a break, I want to go back to William Cole, who's here with us in studio from the Asia Foundation, sort of see things that should be moving toward an Afghan-led government. I mean, with a great sustainability potentially for everything rooted in or anchored in Afghanistan itself. That is, everything from Europe and the United States and North America should be moving toward that.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, Michael. I think the if you look at what we've constructed over the last decade in Afghanistan, in many ways this whole thing has been based on a development model, which is taking Western institutions or Westernized institutions, often Anglo-Saxon institutions, and transferring those to developing countries. This is particularly difficult where you've got a context where you're, in a sense, almost starting from scratch, as we did in Afghanistan. The difficulty is that what you end up with is a set of best practice institutions that you're trying to lay in place, but they don't articulate very well with the underlying distribution of power and influence among the elites. And the result is a lot of corruption, a lot of malfeasance, and a lot of difficulty in terms of sustaining that state.
Hold that thought, because we are coming up on a break, and I want to give out the phone number, and I want our listeners to join us in this conversation. Our toll-free number available to you now is 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the program again. Toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. NATO and Afghan leaders meeting in Chicago formally approved a plan to draw down international forces in Afghanistan. And under the plan, the Afghan military will take the lead role by next summer, though the United States will maintain a presence past 2014. We're discussing the challenges ahead in Afghanistan and the evolving role of NATO in world affairs. William Cole is with us in studio, Senior Director for Governance, Law, and Strategy with the Asia Foundation. With us by phone from Washington, D.C. is Charles Kupchan, who is Senior Fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations and Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown, also former Director for European Affairs at the National Security Council, and author of No One's World, The West, the rising rest and the coming global turn. And Sanwar Kashmeri is with us from Vermont. He's the senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's International Security Program and a fellow with the Foreign Policy Association, author of NATO 2.0, Reboot or Delete. We're going to bring your calls and emails into our discussion here. I wanted to ask you, though, Sanwar Kashmeri, because I read, as I said, your article that appeared in The Guardian with a great deal of interest. And there's a historical milestone that probably many of the listeners don't know about, and that is has to do with Article 5 in terms of NATO. After 9/11, Article 5 essentially said kind of three musketeers, one for all and all for one, and we'll all back each other. And if anybody's attacked, the 18 allies will go to bat for one another. There was some resistance at first from Belgium. And essentially, I think you saw this as a turning point because Secretary Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld, said we don't need help. U.S. will be able to get out of Afghanistan in 3 months. Obviously, he was dreaming. But the fact is that when the NATO allies invaded Iraq, when the United States invaded Iraq, it was sort of everyone to themselves. And this has kind of moved NATO backwards in many ways, I think, from your perspective, hasn't it?
Well, I think it has. I think NATO now has expanded to 28 countries. And besides the fact that they look to the United States for leadership, there is little that connects the Eastern and Central Europeans to the Western Europeans. I mean, as an example, when the Georgia-Russia tussle took place, it took the Russians about 40 hours or so to cross over and occupy the Georgian ports. The French have just sold them an attack amphibious ship, which will let them do that in roughly 2.5 hours if they wish to start that war again. And I'm not criticizing the French here, but I'm simply pointing out that there are different interests now from the Western members of NATO to the Central and Eastern European members of NATO. And when you take that and you add to that the constant regular barrage of criticism that we read in the American press and on the American politicians that the Europeans aren't pulling their weight, that the Europeans aren't paying enough, that they're not real fighters and all of that, it takes away, chips away at the strength of the transatlantic relationship, which I still believe is terribly important. And that's what we have to keep in mind, which is why I've been advocating that the Europeans have made a start to set up their own military establishment, their headquarters. They've fought some pitched battles. Their naval force of Somalia is twice the size of NATO's. Well, let them give them the leadership to defend Europe and its environs, and then the U.S. can be the leader when there's a big bang. So that's where I think we need to be headed.
All right. We're talking really about the results of the Chicago NATO summit, and there was a good deal of protest that went on at that summit. One of the protesters is Jackie Cabasso, who is here back in Oakland in the Bay Area, and she was part of a counter-summit called No to NATO, Counter-Summit for Peace and Economic Justice. And the summit focused, of course, on alternatives to militarism and the costs of it. And many of those who were protesting felt that even though people held diverse views about different issues, the feeling was the same. Everyone was there because the system they felt was broken. Jackie Cabasso, good to have you with us. Do we have Jackie Cabasso?
Yes, hello.
Oh, okay, we do. Yeah, why were you at the protest? Why did you feel you needed to go and protest?
Well, I've actually been attending NATO protests since the mid-1990s because I work with an organization here in the Bay Area, Western States Legal Foundation, which works for nuclear disarmament in a broader context for peace and justice. And NATO is what brings all those issues together. At our counter summit, we were showing all of the different ways in which NATO links together militarism, wars, military spending, nuclear weapons, and economic injustice.
There were a lot of issues, in other words.
There were many, many issues. No,
well,
yes.
Well, really, what I'm getting at, was there anything that really brought the protesters together?
Well, I think that the focal point was getting all of the troops and contractors out of Afghanistan. That was certainly the focal point. There's a lot of discontent in the peace movement about the terms that President Obama has spelled out for getting troops out of Afghanistan, which is going to, if it goes forward the way he's putting it, is going to leave U.S. personnel in Afghanistan for many years, even beyond 2014. But we were also there in that regard to support 46 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who actually returned their medals of honor to NATO as a gesture of protest at the end of the march on Sunday. That unfortunately didn't get the attention I think it deserved. It was a very, very moving experience to observe, and there were several young Afghanistan women there, Afghans for Peace, who were there to say, and who spoke at our conference also, to say, you know, we need the space to build an indigenous nonviolent peace movement. So please get out and let us do that.
And what about the protests themselves? Peaceful? Largely?
The protest on Sunday, which is the only one I can vouch for, was very large, very diverse, and very peaceful until the very end, when it seemed it was inevitable that the police and a handful of the protesters were going to get into a street fight. The police had set it up so that it was impossible to get out without pushing against the barricades. And that's what they. And then there was a small group of people who were intent on mixing it up with the police. So, unfortunately, from the reports that I saw, that small amount of street violence is what got most of the media attention instead of this very significant act which of these veterans returning their medals, which has not happened since Vietnam. And I want to point out that these were all soldiers who had volunteered because they wanted to defend their country and then had come to change their views so radically that they felt that the medals were an embarrassment and they wanted to apologize for what they had done and strive to work for a world in which there aren't going to be any more wars.
Jackie Cabasso, again, one of the organizers of the protest in Chicago, with us this morning from Oakland. Thank you so much for joining us on Forum.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And some of your web comments, actually apropos of comments we just heard from Jackie Cabasso, a listener writes, when I see brutality meted out to protesters and reporters in Chicago by criminal police thugs, and I learn that bogus terrorism charges have been brought against what were essentially unsuccessful vandals, I come to strongly suspect that the people being shielded from largely peaceful dissent could not possibly be as just or innocent as they are portrayed by the corporate media cartel. By attacking protesters so viciously through their proxy, Rahm Emanuel, whose father, incidentally, was a terrorist specializing in bus bombings, NATO has committed human rights abuses inside the USA against the American people. There's another web comment. Why should the U.S. maintain a presence in Afghanistan past 2014 if the French and the other NATO allies, all of whom are equally at risk from Afghanistan becoming a terrorist haven again, are withdrawing their forces entirely? Aren't our European allies freeloading? Why should we have to tighten our spending on things like Social Security and Medicare to pay for frivolous projects like creating a missile shield over Europe and expanding NATO eastward if the Europeans aren't willing to share in that expense? A comment on that, Sarwar Kashmiri?
I think that reader is quite right. I think that NATO ought not to be expanding into Georgia and all these countries that border Russia. I think NATO ought not. I think the United States, the anti-missile defense project is very ill-conceived, and I think the United States would wind up picking up most of the tab. The best estimates we have is that the Europeans will spend, quote-unquote, only $20 million a year on this anti-missile system. Now, that's less than the amount of money it takes to buy an apartment in London or Paris. So Congress is rightly starting to look into this whole issue, and I suspect we'll see some changes very soon.
All right, and let us bring our callers in. Diane is first up here. Good morning, Diane.
Hi, this is Diane LeBeau. I've been a women's studies professor and also a writer that has I've traveled in Afghanistan several times in different contexts with different Afghan women's groups, and things were getting, as we all know, much better by around 2004. We created the Declaration of Essential Rights of Afghan Women that in 2000 that was signed by Kofi Annan, Bill Clinton, and so on. It seems that there's a disconnect I've experienced when I'm there, and also I hear on this program, and I appreciate the program to a great deal, but there's a disconnect. There are a lot of well-meaning men in Afghanistan, including illiterate mujahideen, some of whom are my friends who are not part of the Taliban, do not want to go back to where things were before. And there has been a lot of great development, as Michael referred to, with millions of girls getting education now and schools in the provinces and so on and so forth. And it seems as when I'm there, there's like a disconnect with foreign troops, particularly American troops, stay in their little enclaves. And, of course, now it's more and more dangerous. And somehow we've not, with all our talents and our abilities, we've not connected with these people that have a lot of talent and a lot of power, and especially the women all over Afghanistan, and including this program, you don't have a woman representative. And I know that Secretary Clinton is trying to not let go of the women's rights issues, and it's not just a small thing. I mean, it's more than half the population that will go down into the tank if we just give up on all this. So I don't know if any of these gentlemen have any views of what's going to be done to protect what's been achieved so far.
Yeah, I should mention we did invite a couple of women on this program and struck out just because of schedules and the like. But William Cole, there's a real important question, a salient one here that Diane is raising, and that is how do we make better connection with the Afghan people?
Well, I think on the let me just go to that issue of women, if I could.
Sure. I think it's the same question.
Connecting with women. I think the difficulty is that as long as you, as we were present, as we are present at the levels, at the troop levels, at the level of influence that we have, our ability to call the shots, which it was certainly not absolute, but our ability to call the shots in terms of policy and institution building in Afghanistan, as long as that's there, we can at least on paper ensure all of these rights, rights for women, rights for minorities, and so on. The difficulty is it's precisely as you move the international presidents out, those forces who have the greatest voice in Afghanistan now will begin to reassert themselves, and many of those voices are going to lead in a direction in which we're not going to be very happy on the women's front. One of the things that's always been striking to me. And I don't know if this is widely recognized, but we have a survey that we do. The Asia Foundation has a survey that we do every year in Afghanistan. And one of the things that has been very clear on the issue of women is that most Afghans want their girls educated. They want women to be able to go into the marketplace freely. They want them to be in public freely. They don't agree with what the Taliban had done before in the 1990s. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there isn't as much support as you might expect, as we might hope, for women in senior positions of government. Now, when you combine those two things together, they may look incongruent to us, but they aren't necessarily incongruent to Afghans on the ground. As we move forward and as deals are cut with the Taliban, and as you have more of an Afghan say in what the policies and institutions are going to be, I think you're going to see a slippage of very disappointing, but that's the reality. Slipping in the position of women in Afghanistan. It's not going to go back to where it was in the 1990s, but it'll be a slip from where we would hope it would be. We hope it would become over the next few years. I think there's going to be a slippage.
Well, I thank the caller. I hope slippage doesn't include if you're right about an impression about this, acid in faces and things of that sort, because certainly that was true even beyond the 90s when the Taliban were not in power. Let me go to some more calls here. Colin, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I couldn't help but notice that during the debate for the presidential election, Francois Hollande promised to lower the retirement age back to 60 from the age 62 where Sarkozy had increased it. Here in the U.S., it seems that nonpartisan commissions like Bull Simpson are suggesting that after the next election, we increase the retirement age past 67. My question is, what is the likelihood that there's going to be U.S. support among U.S. voters for providing security through NATO to European allies when they're enjoying much lower retirement age, greater social benefits than we have here at home?
Yeah. Charles Kupchan, can I get you to weigh in on this?
Sure. Just to clarify, Hollande wants to undo only some of the change that Sarkozy implemented. That is, he's not going to wind back everyone from 62 to 60. It's only a relatively small number of the French workforce that had put in a certain number of years. And there's also a silver lining here, and that is that Hollande wants growth. Now, whether he is able to get it is another matter, because he has to convince the German Chancellor Angela Merkel to loosen her very stringent commitment to austerity. But if Hollande succeeds in leading a pro-growth coalition, it may actually benefit the United States, because growth in Europe will come across the shores and help the economy here.
Yeah, but I think we're wondering, or the listener seems to be wondering, whether we're going to be bankrolling French security.
Well, you know, we've always been bankrolling French and European security to some extent, because there's been free riding going on from the start. And one of the reasons the Europeans don't spend more on defense is they don't have to, because Uncle Sam is there to take care of them. I think that may no longer be true, in part because we are pivoting away from Europe. We're drawing down to 30,000. We're focusing more on East Asia. And that may get the Europeans to wake up and do more to produce defense goods. If I could also just add a quick defense of NATO, because there was some, I think, people who were sort of saying it's you know, not worth it. I would simply point out that nobody would have guessed 20 years ago that NATO would still exist, or that it would have been in Afghanistan and Libya. Is it perfect? No. But bad things happen out in the world, and we have to have an alliance around that can use force when necessary. And the answer, the question is not, you know, should or should not we use force? It's, is the U.S. going to do it alone, or is the U.S. going to have partners? And at least for now, NATO helps the United States, because it means that we have partners. They may not be as capable as we want, but at least they're there.
Well, here's a comment on our website from a listener. It says, NATO has no reason to exist, nor has it had one for over 20 years. It is obviously no longer a defensive organization, ostensibly protecting Europe from a Soviet communist invasion, but is now apparently looking around the world for a reason to exist, hence its intervention in Libya. It is so sick that we are slashing pensions, Medicare, government spending on infrastructure, et cetera, but we don't slash this useless, outdated organization. And another question from a listener about the Afghan army. He puts it quite bluntly here. I'll go to you on this, Sarwar Kashmiri. This is Doug who writes, is the Afghan army anything more than Karzai's private security force?
Well, I think it's really instructive to recall the comment that President Gül of Turkey made at when he was leaving the Chicago summit. He said the alliance has not even won over the Afghan troops, leave aside the Afghan people. And he pointed out, you walk out and you see the Afghan troops, some of them without shoes, without helmets. Then you look at the NATO troops, and they're so well attired and so on. So I share those misgivings. And as far as NATO is concerned, I really think since the fall of the since the end of the Cold War, NATO has not been left with a very concrete, well-defined mission. There used to be when you could define NATO's mission in one sentence. It was created, you know, to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. If there is a sentence that describes its mission now, I don't know it. Having said that, it does have a mechanism which lets America and Europe work together if there is a danger. But the point is that America always wants to lead and doesn't want to give up that leadership. And therefore, the Europeans are only too happy to say, well, great, you can have the leadership. You pay for all the tough work that is done, which is why I'm advocating we share the leadership with the Europeans, not get involved in leadership if there is a threat to Europe's security, which there is none, or its environment, as in Libya. You know, everyone says that the Europeans couldn't have done Libya without America. I totally disagree. You have two nuclear powers, France and the United Kingdom. You have six countries that together account for about 90% of the $300 billion defense budget of the EU. So it may have taken longer, but they would have been able to do Libya on their own. And that's my point. So the quicker we can get to an equilibrium with the Europeans, it'll strengthen the transatlantic relationship, and it'll create a lot more friendly atmosphere here as far as this caller's statement, which I think is largely true, is that the Europeans don't want to make the hard decisions because they have this American credit card.
A listener named Dennis writes, in lieu of fixing Afghanistan, we should clobber any rebuilt al-Qaeda bases from without until the locals tire of it and drive them out of their own volition. No one can fault us for self-defense. Actually, coming up on another break here, but I'm thinking about the fact that we haven't even discussed the possibility of civil war in Afghanistan, which is real, or of the way the Afghans are used to looking at things in terms of the United States expanding its bases near the Afghan border, which in terms of occupation, from their point of view, is really a major. Want to say something about that, William Cole?
Well, I think in terms of a civil war, that's talked about a lot. You know, one of the things that as we just to take a couple of points, as we continue to press for some kind of an agreement with the Taliban, and the Peace Council, Karzai's Peace Council was trying to move in that direction. The difficulty is that you got the what's often called the Northern Alliance, the Northern ethnic groups who are absolutely opposed to having the Taliban back in government in any form. So trying to square that circle is not an easy one. That we're at the very early stages of any kind of negotiation, so there's no content in the negotiation in terms
Hold
of what exactly
for a second.
We would.
I just need to mention that you, the listeners, that is, are listening to KQED's forum, and we're talking with William Cole, with Sarwar Kashmiri, with Charles Kupchan, and this is a fundraising period for this radio station. For more information about how to support KQED, please go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Sorry, please go again, if you would, William Cole.
Let's see. Well, where were we?
You were talking about the Northern Alliance. And,
yeah. No, I think that just to reiterate that point. Yes, if you push too hard for too much for too many points for allowing too much acquiescence to Taliban demands, you'd have a serious problem in the north. The other problem is that as you have Western troops out, you have a limited capacity. Inevitably, a limited capacity in the Afghan army, you're going to see a rise of not just Taliban, but you're going to see a rise of assertion of influence by various warlords around the country. The government is likely to be able to hold the cities going forward, but you're going to see increasing problems in the countryside. Now, that's not a full out civil war, but what it is it's a constant and creeping loss of an ability to control territory by Kabul. And I think that is almost inevitable looking over the next 5, 6, 7 years.
Let me bring another caller on, and thanks, Don, for waiting. Join us.
Good morning, and thank you very, very much for having me on the show. You know, we went to Afghanistan to get bin Laden because of his involvement in 9/11. We did that. End of story. Our role is finished. Why are we there? Trying to nation build? Are we there for women's rights, civil rights in Afghanistan? Hundreds of millions of American dollars being spent there for what? Essentially, this is all about Obama's reelection and nothing more.
Why are we in Afghanistan? I remember that question about Vietnam. Well, Charles Kupchan, I suppose the obvious answer for many would be that we're protecting ourselves from Afghanistan continuing to be any kind of sanctuary for al-Qaeda, which it was under the Taliban. But there are other interests as well that one could argue. And yet, how much of this is political? I mean, President Obama made this his war. He said Iraq is not our war. Our war should be in Afghanistan. And now he is running for reelection and would like to keep his promise of getting out.
Well, I think that the United States went into Afghanistan for good reasons. They're reasons that Don identified, and that is we had to get the bad guys who carried out 9/11 or supported 9/11. But what happened, I think, over the course of the Bush administration, the early part of the Obama administration, is that our aspirations extended too far. I think in some ways we misread what happened in Iraq, where the United States was able to turn the insurgency and to win over the Sunni tribes, and that sort of worked in creating a more functioning state. We thought we could do that in Afghanistan, but the tribal structure there is much more fragmented, and therefore it was a bridge too far. And what I think is happening now and was on show at the NATO summit is folks have realized that, and that's why they're scaling back the ambition, scaling back the mission, focusing mainly on the bad guys, and trying to get out in a way that leaves behind a semblance of order in the country. But I think, as Obama said when he was in Kabul a couple of weeks ago, we see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Let me thank the caller and move right on to Chris in Oakland. Good morning.
Good morning. Back in the Najibullah days, the CIA introduced Saudis and Saudi money to Muslim extremists to fight the Soviets. I mean, that's how bin Laden got there. To what extent is Saudi money still funding the Taliban?
Do we know that, Sarwar Kashmiri? Do we have any gleaning?
I don't think we know that. I think there is Saudi money that pays for some of the madrasas, the religious institutions, and the publications of Qurans and holy book for distribution within Pakistan. And by the way, I think we should spend a couple of minutes on Pakistan. I think your previous caller was entirely right, and Charlie Kaplan is, that American influence in Afghanistan is rapidly, rapidly dissipating.
I wish we had a couple of minutes to spend on Pakistan. Actually, we talked about the concern over the diplomatic mission and not meeting the president of Pakistan, but we've run to the end of this hour, and we have certainly, I think, provided a good deal of light, and I want to thank those of you who participated with us on the panel this morning. Sarwar Kashmiri, senior fellow with the Atlantic Council's International Security Program and a fellow with the Foreign Policy Association, author of NATO 2, Reboot or Delete, Charles Kupchan, senior fellow of the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international affairs at Georgetown, former director for European affairs at the National Security Council and author of No One's World, The West, The Rising West, and The Coming Global Turn, and William Cole, who is here with us in studio, senior director for governance, law, and strategy with the Asia Foundation. Thank you, our listeners. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegas Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.